tonight on Arena. Toya Wilcox on lockdown lunches, dyeing her hair bright blue before it was fashionable, and making films with Derek Jarman. To a generation of teenagers and beyond in the 1980s, Toya Wilcox was an inspiration with brightly dyed hair, dramatic makeup and songs like I Want to Be Free being a call to arms. But before her success in the music world, she'd already made her stage debut at the National Theatre in London and her film debut with director Derek Jarman. For four decades, the work continues unabated. She's just returned to the recording studio. New solo album, Posh Pop, due for release in July, and a remastered edition of The Blue Meaning, her studio album from 1980, comes out this month. And delighted to have Toya Wilcox join me on Arena. Toya, hi, how are you doing? Great to speak with you. I'm skipping over four decades there very quickly, but I want to actually just talk initially about the last year. Tell those who haven't been initiated into Toya and Robert's Sunday lunches, tell them what's involved there.
Well, it's a massive success. We have traffic of 16.7 million viewing Toya YouTube every month. And we cannot put our finger on why this has just gone viral. It's basically Robert, my husband, and I in our kitchen. We've never changed that setting. And the kitchen seems to be as much a star as we are. So it started off with a very simple dance video, 30-second video, exactly a year ago, which within 1 minute had reached 100,000 people, and most of them seemed to be in the Philippines. And we were absolutely amazed by this. So we started to regularly release videos at Sunday lunch at a time when we believed, and we still do believe, that we as musicians need an audience and an audience needs us. And the idea was, we just wanted to say to people who were good enough to watch that we are in this with you. And it had a profound effect. I do admit to the audiences out there who haven't seen Toya and Robert that we pushed the boundaries and the bar out more and more each week. And I'm not sure we can push that boundary out anymore. But we've now reached an international rock audience to the point where we know that the drummer from Radiohead, Alice Cooper, and various other iconic people are watching our videos, and they are trending them. Wow. And it's just been fabulous. Yeah. To the point that we are now deciding that in about 2 to 3 years' time that this will become our main career. My husband turns 75 any day now, and I turn 63. And we've decided we're going to build this as our kind of retirement career.
What a plan. And we should point out that your husband isn't any old Robert. He's Robert Fripp of King Crimson, the guitarist. So we're talking serious musical pedigree there as well. Now, you've talked about...
He's in the top 50 of world guitarists.
Yeah,
yes.
he can play. Let's put it that way. Let's have a listen to, I think this is actually, was it last Sunday? It's a very recent Sunday at any rate, where you took on basically what yourself and Robert do in these videos. You take on, I suppose, songs that we all know and love, and lots of them that I think speak directly to your own aesthetic. This is Firestarter from The Prodigy.
Okay, let me explain. Yeah. I perform these to two guitarists, and I have no microphone and I have no in-ear. This is me purely responding in the room. It's not even karaoke. This is performance art.
That's exactly what it is. And I have to say, you didn't mention for me one of the stars of this particular video, which is the copper pot hanging above your aga. Let's have a listen to how that all works.
1, 2, 3, 4.
If you haven't seen the visuals, wait until this interview is over. In fact, wait until this programme is over and go and check them out. That is Toya and Robert's Sunday Lunch. Toya Wilcox speaking with me this evening. And the Copper Pot in the midst of the stars in that video as well. Sydney Jake was the other guitarist, as you mentioned, Toya. I'm the trouble starter, punkin' instigator. I'm the fear addicted, a danger illustrated. I'm a fire starter, twisted fire starter. Did the Prodigy write those lyrics about you?
No, this is the Prodigy.
I know that, but it sounds like you, doesn't it?
Not today. I mean, we did that as a tribute to Keith, who was a gorgeous, gorgeous human being. And we pick songs and we treat them as tributes to the original artist. You're right, but there is a little bit of me in that song, but I think there's a little bit of everybody in that song.
Yeah.
I mean, where the Prodigy were absolutely phenomenal was they created a very special energy that the world followed, and we wanted to pay tribute to Keith. I think part of the success of this particular video you've picked up on is the huge copper jam-making pot that I use as the percussion. And this is, we think this is part of the success of Toya and Robert at Home, is that we use kitchen implements in the videos, and it's slightly absurd.
But it's brilliantly absurd at the same time as well. I'm wondering how difficult it was to get Robert to join in. At this stage, I went down a Toya and Robert Sunday Lunch rabbit hole, I have to admit, last night on YouTube as I was getting ready to speak with you. And I had such a great time. Initially, I wondered, particularly in the Swan Lake video where you're in the garden, in fact, was that the initial dance video you were talking about? He's in the black tutu, you're in the black tutu going across the lawn?
The initial dance video was me teaching him to jive to Rock Around the Clock. I realised that this very brilliant guitarist who plays very complicated time signatures had no control of his body. I mean, he cannot dance. So the choo-choo came about when it's something I've always wanted to do. We live on the River Avon near Stratford, and I have always wanted to do Swan Lake that way. And I just thought, I said to Robert, would you wear a choo-choo? And he wasn't happy about it, but he trusts me. And that particular video reached the world press. I mean, we started to make headlines on front pages of newspapers from Italy to the USA with that one. And at that point, Robert wasn't too happy to be seen across the world in a tutu like that. But very quickly, people realized that in a time of extreme danger and fear, that one of the things the human race can turn to is humor. And that was the turning point of our success.
I have to say too, though, Toya, yes, they're very humorous and there's an absurdity to them, but there's also something incredibly creative about some of the ones that I was watching last night. I'm thinking in particular of You Really Got Me, The Kinks, and the way you shot this, a filmmaker would be proud of it. Robert is...
Explain the shot. By the way, I have just directed and filmed 10 videos for my new album, Posh Pop. So I know how to make really good short films. So I set this camera up. We live in a 5-floor property with a stairwell. And I just always thought, as soon as we moved into this property 20 years ago, that is a fabulous shot. And Robert was very, very happy to do the shot when I set it up. So I had to build a very easy scaffold rig to suspend the camera down the 3 stairwells we were shooting from. We removed all the furniture so that we could put Robert on his back looking up to the top camera, which was 3 floors up at this particular part of the house, looking down on this beautiful mosaic tiles. And Robert was playing The Kinks, You Really Got Me Going. Well, the thing about this video is he plays virtually every chord wrong. Robert plays in viola tuning, which is 5 tones higher than guitar tuning. So this was the beginning of Robert realizing if he was going to have to learn classic rock, he was going to have to go back to E tuning. But that's a technicality.
Yeah.
I think most of your listeners will understand what I've just said. So I was trying to sing dressed as a little red demon running up and down the stairwell, the three floors, to a tuning I was not getting back off my master guitarist. But it is a visual feast. It's a beautiful looking film.
Yeah, because the tiles on the floor, as we look from up above, look absolutely amazing with Robert Lang on them. And it's a great shot.
And I look amazing too.
Yes, you do look amazing in your red, that red PVC suit that you're wearing there, and some of the costumes that you wear throughout the videos are to be seen rather than to be spoken about. I shall put it that way.
And I would say this is for viewing over 18 years of age.
Yes, yeah.
But there you go. And I would like to say that I'm pushing out the boundaries that no matter what age you are, we are still connected to rock and roll.
For sure. And that brings me to that earlier part of your career, which is what we're talking about everything tonight that we want to talk about, I suppose, but it was specifically about the remastered edition of The Blue Meaning, your studio album from 1980. Now, ironically, it's not just that album, it has to be said. It's a massive big collection of music that you've given us. In fact, it's a two-disc collection. There are extra songs in there, some that were from a deluxe edition, I think, that you released later on. But there's also one of your best hits, which isn't on the album itself. I know that, but it's the one that I think a lot of listeners will recognise the minute they hear it. Let's just release. This is on the second disc from the set that you're re-releasing at the moment.
So often I have heard his cry and forgotten what it said. It's a mystery.
That is so beautiful to hear in that original version, It's a Mystery, which is part of the double set. I know that the real focus is The Blue Meaning, the album itself, but It's a Mystery, just listening to that lyric in there, It's a Mystery to Me, Still Searching for a Clue. It strikes me that the part of that is still happening for you, Toya Wilcox, but not in any kind of way that makes you anxious, and in a way that makes you excited, in fact, that you're constantly searching.
I mean, that was the very first demo of It's a Mystery, and it was done with a band called Blood Donor, who the keyboard player had written that song. And so that was a very avant-garde demo. Mm. And then we re-recorded it after the writer and myself turned it into a different arrangement, and I wrote the second verse for the single, and it became much more of a commercial entity. But the meaning in the song for me is life is a journey, and I was brought up that as soon as you left the school gates at 17 or 18, education stopped. Well, that's just not true. And as soon as you hit 30, you're in old age. Well, that's just not true. And I think that this song represents the fact that life is a journey, and it's always a rite of passage. We're always learning new things, experiencing new things, and life is an adventure. And that, I think, is a very special meaning within It's a Mystery.
And also that period in time, I mentioned in my introduction, you had already had success. You were on the stage of the National Theatre, and you'd been in Derek Jarman's, specifically, you'd been in Jubilee, I think, at that point in time. But that
Quadrophenia, and I've been in a movie with Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah, and Katharine Hepburn was actually, this brings us to a great story around your dyed hair. Everybody thinks, that was the punk era. Of course she had dyed hair, but you had dyed hair much earlier than many others. I think, were you in your very early teens when you first dyed your hair, a bright blue or a bright pink?
When I was 14, I was a hair model for a very famous UK department store. So my hair started to be dyed when I was 14, and I got threatened to be chucked out of school. It was such a taboo thing to do that buses wouldn't stop for me. People used to shout at me very unpolitely, adding a lot of swear words before this. What are you? And bleep, bleep, clown. It was an incredibly aggressive statement for a woman to have made in the mid-70s. Today, when I look out and I see women of all ages with pink, blue, green hair, I think, yes, This is why my generation did it. But back then, you were seen as someone standing outside of society, and it was taken as an aggressive statement. So I was a hair model. I adored having all these different colours. And when I met Katharine Hepburn for the audition of Bessie Watty, a 13-year-old, in a classic play called The Corn is Green for a movie, I wore a wig. I wore my National Theatre wig, which was a beautiful brown wig. When I got the job, I turned up for the play reading with Katharine Hepburn with my bright red hair. And she fell in love with it. And she said that is exactly who and what she was when she was a teenager embarking in Hollywood. And she adored it. She got it immediately.
Yeah. And in fact, George Cukor, who was the director, had seen you in the wig. And when he saw you with the bright pink hair the following day, he was going, Who's this person?
Well, and you've got to remember, this is the man that discovered Marilyn Monroe and James Dean. He also directed Judy Garland in A Star is Born, and suddenly he's got this young 19-year-old turning up with bright red hair. It was a complete leap of faith for him at that time.
I want to bring you to Derek Jarman and that relation. How did that relationship start, first of all? Was it Ian Charleston, the actor who introduced you to Jarman?
Yeah, Ian Charleston and I were at the National Theatre together in very different productions. But Ian Charleston knew Derek Jarman and felt that Derek would love to meet me. And that led to us going to tea with Derek Jarman. And Derek literally just handed me a script and said, pick the part you want. And Derek and me, we loved each other very, very much. The bond was immediate. And I went on to do The Tempest with him as well.
I have a little clip from the dinner scene in Jubilee. It's a short monologue. Was your character in Jubilee simply called Mad? Mad with a capital M.
That's it. Mad the Pyromaniac.
Mad the Pyromaniac. Fire starting seems to be our theme this evening, doesn't it? Let's have a listen to this little clip from the dinner scene then of Derek Jarman's Jubilee.
Ruins. All this concrete, brick and glass, and the people who made them are utterly forgotten. The prisons we live in today might have taken more than a day to build, but it doesn't take long to destroy them.
That's the dinner scene from Derek Jarman's Jubilee. Toya Wilcox, a very young Toya Wilcox, performing there. Does that bring back memories? It must do, Toya.
I remember it vividly. I mean, I remember that it was part of a 10-page scene that I was speaking for the whole of the time. So I remember the technicality of it.
I'd say.
The camera was trying to find me. I was trying to find the camera. I do remember it. It was an incredibly happy time because it was my very first feature film. It was such an opportunity, and Derek Jarman trusted in me, but it's very, very embryonic in my performance. And I still feel very embryonic as a film actress, because film acting is about experience. But I loved every minute of making this, but it was extra special because it was my first movie.
Yeah, and Ian Charleston, I think, was at that dinner table. Adam Ant was there as well, if I remember right. Ruth Rinneker was there as well.
Yeah, Adam Ant, Little Nell from the Rocky Horror Picture Show movie. It was absolutely an iconic cast.
Yeah, and all of that film experience and Derek Jarman's aesthetic, I think, is there even in the Sunday Lunch videos that we were talking about earlier on. And I guess it will be all over the new album, Posh Pop, given that you've said it really is. You feel that the videos and the songs are pretty much an item together rather than separate in the case of the upcoming album, Posh Pop, yeah?
Because Posh Pop was written in lockdown, I created a pod with my co-writer, Simon Darlow. We feel that this album is about humanity, and it's about humanity at a time where we were joined like no other time in our living history. So Posh Pop is about joy, the need to dance. It's about connection, love and loss. So this is why I've made the video album to go with this album. It's one of the most special things I have ever made. It is, for me, a very perfect album, but what sounds like a pop album has the deepest messages I've ever written about.
To finish up then, Tyo Wilcox, I want to go to The Blue, meaning the deluxe edition, the remastered edition that we're getting and that we're celebrating with you this evening. And that opening track, now we get an 8:31 version of this song on the new album. That's a short version in comparison to some of the rehearsals you had for it. Rehearsals almost in front of live audiences. Tell us about gigs where you basically tried this song out and the audience were there while you were working out new versions of it.
Yeah, well, IER was written at sound checks, and we often so love playing this. It has a kind of trance effect about it that we would get through our entire set in an evening, an hour and a half. We'd do 5 encores and the audience was still calling out for more. So we were put in a situation that we wanted to play something new. So we would develop IER live on stage in front of the audience. And you're right, live, this could go on for half an hour or more. And so we developed the arrangement and the energy and the connection with the audience actually in front of a live audience. And then we went into the studio 6 months later to record it. And I think that's why this song is so special, is because we know exactly how the audience were going to behave when they heard certain parts of it. And even today, it's our encore number and the audience go absolutely bonkers.
Tyo, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks a million for being with us.
Thank you so much, Sean. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, the title of the track, the opening track on the 1980 album from Tyo Wilcox, The Blue Meaning. And the reissue of that album will be available from the 28th of May. That's on Cherry Red Records. The new album that Tyo Wilcox told us about there, Posh Pop, will be released in July on Demon Records. And well worth checking out is Tyo and Robert's Sunday Lunch videos, published at 12 p.m. each Sunday on YouTube. Really will lift your spirits if you're so inclined. The ancient Greek term demos is used to denote a district or land as well as the people within it. Demos, films of celebration, separation and togetherness from Liz Roach Dance Company and Crash Ensemble brings together dancers and musicians who question how to feel together in a time when togetherness feels fractured. These short films were made on the Abbey stage in collaboration with filmmaker Jose Miguel Jimenez and will culminate in a live performance later this year. But joining me this evening to talk about the films, which will be shown as part of this year's Dublin Dance Festival, are choreographer Liz Roach and composer David Coonan. Liz, I believe this idea, you know, when I read about films of separation and togetherness, I thought, well, that's a COVID idea, if ever there was a COVID idea. But in fact, I think the beginnings of it predate lockdown, do they?
Yeah. No, we first started talking about the piece in 2018, myself and David. And I suppose we had a plan for a piece that was about large ensembles of musicians and dancers working together. And then, of course, as COVID hit, we had to really rethink how we could still make a piece about, I suppose, states of connection and togetherness under the restrictions that we're in at the moment. But in a way, actually, all these restrictions have ended up shaping the piece, and we've come to, I suppose we now have something, a little unexpected, but also kind of relevant to this time, but still with some of what we started out with. We didn't lose as much as we thought we might.
And it is quite extraordinary how, you know, so many people have spoken to me over the past number of months where ideas that they had that predated everything to do with lockdown suddenly took on a new relevance, almost took on a new set of meanings, but were still related to that initial idea that they had. This is the second year, Liz, as well, that the Dublin Dance Festival has had to go online. Second year around, was it easier to plan towards that? Was it less of a big unknown chasm?
Well, I think last year we were just all still learning. It was just completely getting through it. But, we've had a year and a lot has changed in the year and a lot of lives have been really affected by all of these experiences. And I think, again, you know, there's always the hope. It's really hard to express dance not in a live setting, and it's always difficult to bring it into film. And, of course, there was a hope that we would have the possibility of live performance. But, again, you know, you have to just be resourceful and you have to find a way. And there are ways of still exploring all of these ideas through film, and film also is really beautiful in that sense. You know, it gives us other opportunities that we don't have in live performance. And I suppose at the moment we just have to take what we can and keep on going.
I'll come back to the specifics of how you've realised these ideas of separateness and togetherness in terms of the choreography. But let me talk to David a little bit at this point. You and Liz had worked, and ironic that this should be on the stage of the Abbey Theatre, because it was at the Abbey that you had previously worked together, David.
Yes, Liz and I first met and worked together on a production of Anna Karenina, which was at the Abbey in 2016. It was an adaptation by Marina Carr and directed by Wayne Jordan. And Liz was doing movement direction and I was writing the music. And we had one big set piece in that show that was fairly extensive in terms of the exchange between the music and the dance, or the movement. And we kind of got to know each other really well through that as our first sort of meeting. Yeah.
And obviously, probably even at that early stage, ideas started to float around in the ether, as they do between two creative artists that ultimately came to what we're speaking about this evening. I use the term demos or demos. This is also the root of the word democracy. Has that informed, in some ways, how you approach the composition? Did the music actually come first before the movement, or how did that work?
Yeah, I think throughout the sort of process of making the piece, there's been sort of exchanges back and forth between Liz and I. And my background as a composer would be in fairly scored music. I write for like orchestras and quartets and choral music and that kind of musicianship where everything's really written. And yeah, there was quite a lot of me exchanging music that had been scored with Liz, and she would respond to it. And then in two of these films that you'll see on the release tomorrow, we also had improvisations conceived with the musicians of Crash Ensemble, these incredible musicians. And it was an opportunity, as you said, a kind of democratic exchange, whereas I had sort of offered scored music at the beginning and Liz responded. Then we were improvising music to dance that had a more sort of had solidified before the music had happened. So yeah, it was a process of exchange between the musicians and the dancers, composer and choreographer, and we kind of came to things together.
Yeah, because one of the things that struck me watching the films today, Liz, was in fact the presence of the musicians on the stage, or in one case actually very much almost part of the dance, the very final dance in the piece, which is a solo piece if I remember correctly, and the guitarist features quite predominantly in that, as much as the dancer, but the two things really do work together. Was it very important to have the two elements present on stage as things were happening for you, Liz?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when we first started talking about this piece and also talking with Crash Ensemble, there was that sense of trying to find ways to, I suppose, have a sense of equality on stage, you know, and to kind of try and develop a new relationship between dance and music in that way of, yeah, I suppose being in and out of each other's worlds as much as possible and being inspired by each other as much as possible. And also when it came to, you know, the setting of the piece with Katie Davenport's set and costumes and Sinead McKenna's lighting, there was that sense of, you know, they also really contributed to trying to bring us together in the space. So that was like, there was that, you know, it was very much a part of it. Like, how can we have this kind of intimate feeling still on stage and also like between the performers?
Yes, and in fact, sometimes it's in the final piece called Landscapes, we do see the guitars there quite a bit as the soloist dances. But there are other times when it's as simple as just seeing maybe the dance through the prism of from behind one of the instruments. I think there's a vibraphone there at a certain point, and we see the dance from behind the sticks of the vibraphone or the marimba, whichever it is. And even that kind of gives you a sense of this complete performance. Maybe talk to me a little bit, Liz, about, you know, obviously when you're dancing with somebody, the physical connection is hugely important. How difficult was it? I know we have one couple present, but let's leave that aside for just a moment. How difficult was it to actually choreograph where you couldn't have physical contact between dancers?
It can be challenging, but I suppose it just had to become about that. You know, so how could the group manage? How could the dancers manage? How could they feel connected to each other? And how could they really be relying on each other without touching? And in a way, I suppose when you follow that path, possibilities arise. Like there's all a whole other kind of bed of sensitivities become available in terms of hearing each other and taking cues from each other and finding ways of connecting. Like in a way, even though there are within the group sections people couldn't touch, we just had to find other ways to make connection.
And I guess the other aspect of this is there are times in choreography that it's not just about people, you know, touching and moving, holding each other in whatever way the dance might demand. There's also this idea that it's actually about the shapes and the spaces in between the people as much as it is about the two people being together.
Oh, absolutely. And actually, when you stand back, even somebody standing on stage, you know, with nothing happening can have huge resonance and huge meaning. And as you say, those spaces in between, especially now, become so important. So absolutely. And there's, yeah, all this meaning is possible. And standing back from it, I suppose you have an opportunity to look at it through new eyes.
So we have pieces as different. It's the same company throughout, but different combinations, obviously, of dancers involved. Pieces called Travelling Back, Breach, Earthquake, Catching Falling Landscapes, and Hand in Hand is another one that I'll come back to. But let me talk a little bit about Earthquake. And, you know, because when we hear the word earthquake, David, we think, oh, this is the musician now wants to make a lot of noise. That's what's going to be involved here. But that's not necessarily what we get. Maybe talk to us a little bit about what you thought musically in terms of this piece, Earthquake.
Yeah, I think the sort of the interest of the title Earthquake in that film is not just to do with the music, but it's to do with the relationship between the music and the dance. So what you hear if you listen to the music on its own is it's actually there's nothing really earthquake-ish about it. It's quite gentle. It's quite meditative. It's lilting almost. And although as a statement, like the music is quite strong and the dance is equally strong, perhaps there's maybe something a little bit more earthquake-ish about the movement of the dance. What really feels like an earthquake is the space that happens in between. And, you know, we had been working in the rehearsal room and, you know, the thing that sprung to mind for us about this particular piece is like those moments in, you know, World War II movies or something like Saving Private Ryan at the end where, you know, he's caught amidst a huge amount of basically like action and violence and all you hear is the sort of stillness and ringing of his ears. And actually what feels like a real shook earthquake is the emotional space that you're brought into by the juxtaposition of that sound and those images. Right. And I feel there's something that we reach about in this piece that feels like that kind of an earthquake.
Mm. little section there from the music for Earthquake, David Coonan's music, and this is for the upcoming piece that choreographer Liz Roach and David are speaking to me about this evening from the Liz Roach Company, a piece called Demos, Films of Separation and Togetherness. Liz, I've avoided, I mentioned Hand in Hand as one of the pieces. There is a couple within the dance troupe, and that provided you with the opportunity for physical contact, because obviously they were living in the same bubble.
Yeah, absolutely. Luke Murphy and Emily turned up together in life, and beautiful dancers. So there was a fantastic opportunity there to work with them this year. And also just the opportunity that we could, we have the possibility of contact again in the work. So it was really... It became, really interesting in the working process, because, I had an idea before going into rehearsals. I thought at last, it's been a whole year, no touching. And we've worked a lot this year and we've just had to find ways around it. So at last I had my opportunity. But then actually when we got into the room, I found that really simple things were so meaningful and affecting that I was a bit like... originally I had thought, I'll just get them all mashed up against each other and it'll all be... And it was just like, no, just stay back, just maybe hold hands. That's enough. That's all I can take right now.
Yeah, I found that quite powerful, in fact, that, because again, like you, I thought, oh, the hand in hand. I didn't know about the couple aspect of this. But when they touched hands, I thought, all right, clearly there's a couple aspect here, or there's some kind of bubble that you had, because you were doing everything within all the restrictions and obeying all the rules. I thought this could become quite convoluted and we'll see the bodies enmeshed and twisting in and turning in around each other. But in fact, that simple gesture of hand-holding became so potent in the midst of all this separateness.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also just that feeling of isolation, like being together in amongst all that enormous stage space, and that sense of, I suppose, just finding connection in this sort of sea of nothingness was, for me, like really affecting. And I'm glad that it sort of hit home with you there.
Yeah, and there's another aspect, and I don't want to give anything away, but there is a moment when we see outside the Abbey Theatre, which is very powerful as well, given the emptiness of the streets that we see. Great to speak with both of you this evening. That's Liz Roach and David Coonan there, the composer and choreographer, respectfully, of Demos, Films of Separation and Togetherness. It will be on as part of the Dublin Dance Festival Summer 2021 edition, which runs from the 18th through until the 29th of May. And you can find out full details on dublindancefestival.ie. A native of Mullingar, County Westmeath, singer-songwriter Peter Dorn has just released his fifth album. It's called Voices. The songs on the album were developed over a 4 or 5 year period, many from the splendid isolation of a 200-year-old farmhouse just outside Mullingar. I'll be talking to Peter in a moment, but let's have a listen to one of the songs on the album. This is None the Wiser.
Funny how we end up, funny how it goes. Everybody tells you, but they don't know. Funny how we all go chasing down different roads. Funny when we come back fully grown and none the wiser.
That's a song called None the Wiser from Voices, the new album from Peter Dorn, and Peter joining me on the phone this evening. Really struck by the stories that you tell in that song, None the Wiser, Peter. We heard the guts of two of them there, or the beginnings of two of them there. This idea that, we all end up going down different roads. We may not know what those roads are or where they're going to take us. Was this actually born out of looking around your hometown and seeing guys that you knew at school? Because that's what it tells, a series of stories about people that you knew when you were younger.
Yeah, that's pretty much the situation. And it's not always guys that you were really close with necessarily, but like when you're from a not too big town or city, you kind of, it's almost like you can keep an eye on people as they get older or something, and you're watching yourself and you're watching your community, and it's it was kind of born out of just seeing a guy that I remember from school. Like, we never hung out or anything. But you just think, you know, maybe I haven't seen this guy in 25 years, whatever. And then you put together whatever small little bit of information you might have about them. And, you know, your mind just gets wandering about, what have you been up to, or what have you tried, or, and then you're also, and just that idea of then coming back after going out into the world and trying a load of different stuff. And I don't know, maybe it's something about being in your kind of mid-30s, but a lot of people that I do know, you know, who would travel to Australia for work or London or whatever, a lot of people are kind of returning. And it's just that idea of, you know, what do we learn in our adventures, or...
And also, I suppose, people that you thought were going to go one direction when they were at school are in a totally different situation now, either more or less than what you thought they might have achieved. What about yourself? Funny how we all up chasing down different roads. Was it always the music road that you chased down, Peter?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. I mean, it has been since I kind of fell in love very early on with guitar from, you know, the age of 11. And I remember doing kind of Leaving Cert, and you kind of then that's all I wanted to try and pursue for better or for worse. I remember having I was pretty good in school, and I was, you know, I had a career guidance teacher who was kind of rooting for me big time. And then I told him, you know, I don't really want to go to college. I just want to try and do music. And I feel like he fell out with me a little bit over there. So yeah, for better or worse, that's where my love is.
And there is a song on the album called Ageless Song where you really talk about the power of music and the facility that it has. You're talking about Lennon and McCartney was yesterday, always there, just waiting for them to find it. You talk about Michael Jackson, you talk about Madonna, you talk about Prince. Is that song really for us a guide to Peter Doran's record collection?
It probably is, yeah. I mean, without it setting out to do that. Yeah, it's just I wanted to... Actually, that song started, I had an idea to do it even broader, was to try and somehow track the evolution of humanity in a four-minute song, which can't really be done. But I had, in some of the early sketches of that song, there was some little notes about musicians. And a good friend of mine, a songwriter from Mullingar, said, that's quite interesting. Why don't you try and just focus on on that one thing? So, yeah, it was the idea of just the kind of... the way humanity is drawn towards song, I suppose, and story. And I just pictured that kind of spirit, that muse or whatever has been there from the very beginning. And anyone who's ever, you know, written anything written a symphony or written a pop song, it's all kind of, I like the idea that it was all coming from the same source.
And, same well.
Kind of, yeah, yeah. And, you know, from going from singing around, you know, fires and in caves when we were way, 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 way back when. So it's all just based from this ageless song. So I was trying to be just kind of be playful, not too serious.
I did listen to a fair amount of geography when I was at school, but I never heard of this mountain range near Mullingar. Let's have a little listen to a song. It's second track on the album, Blue Mountains.
I never been to the Blue Mountains, but I've been there in a song. Never ever loved like this one, just keeps rolling on. And I never been hit by lightning, but I know that life is long. I've never been to the Blue Mountains, but I've been there in a song.
I just wanted to play the first verse of that, Peter, because it's such good fun. But what you explore here is, first of all, the Blue Mountains. You've never been to the Blue Mountains. You've never been to America. Well, maybe you've been to America, but you've never been to the Blue Mountains. But you've been there in a song. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so I was at a show in Vicker Street a number of years ago, and there was a songwriter called Sam Amidon. He wasn't the main act. I think he was the opening act. And I really enjoyed his set, but he played a song called Blue Mountains. And basically, you know, whatever it was about the mood in the night and just the way the song is quite almost hypnotic or something. So I felt like like really in a trance, and like I was almost there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it gave me this sense of, you know, imagining this idyllic, perfect place. So that's what the Blue Mountains is to the guy in you know, the character in this song of mine, Blue Mountains. And yeah, it's just somewhere he wants to go to kind of live out his days in a perfect kind of isolation with his loved one.
Yeah, well, do you not have that already with your 200-year-old farmhouse? Sounds like the idyllic setting to be in during these lockdown times and for a bit of songwriting.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. We're very lucky to have it. And in fact, we just filmed an official music video for Blue Mountain, and we're lucky. There's a beautiful old wall garden that comes with the house, so we kind of filmed the official thing there. And so yeah, it certainly has a. It's a good place to be, you know, at any time, but in the middle of a pandemic or at the end of a pandemic, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should mention, of course, that Hayley Hendricks was the other singer on Blue Mountains with you there. Congrats on the album, Peter, and thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Peter Doran there. And the album that Peter's been speaking to us about is his new album, which is called Voices, available now on all major platforms. That is our lot for this Monday evening here in Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sheila Neveal was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. I will be back with you once again tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1.